Meditieren, Yoga, Joggen, nichts entspannt mich.
Echt? Mich entspannt meine Steuer total.
Steuer? Wie Finanzamt? Die Steuererklärung?
Ja, ich habe ganz locker über 1000 Euro zurückbekommen.
Hast du geheime Connections oder Excel-Superkräfte?
Nö, nur die Wieso-Steuer-App.
Wow, und das ist einfach?
Klar, die macht fast alles automatisch.
Ich fühle mich plötzlich so entspannt.
Hol dir dein Geld zurück. Abgabefrist 31. Juli.
Was?
Schaffst du ganz entspannt mit Wieso-Steuer.
Ach, ja.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 33, Episode 18. Coming up on the show, we've got more dreams of future Tokyo, the Wu family possession, and the wave of the Metaloids. I'm your host, Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
You've been having some unusual dreams this week, I hear.
I haven't been sleeping this week, but when I have been, pretty unusual dreams.
Well, you sent me this text message out of nowhere, and you're like, I just had the most crazy lucid dream. I'm like, okay, I'm intrigued. I'll tell you on the show.
It's the first lucid dream I've ever had in my life. I've never had a lucid dream.
No, neither have I. I mean, maybe I've come close, but not complete and out of control. But you mentioned that you use some technique of looking at your hands.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, we covered that great story from, who was it, Samantha Treasure. She had that new book, Out of Body Experiences, and she described her trips to future Tokyo.
That's right.
She'd been having these dreams ever since she could remember of arriving in this mall in some future Tokyo scenario, some weird parallel universe. But as she got older, she got into out of body experiences through Robert Monroe's techniques. And she found she kept on going back to this same place. It was like a stable, recurring universe just in her dreamscape and in her out-of-body experiences.
Or an actual place that through those experiences she was accessing.
Yeah, it was very, very strange. And she also had a friend who just on an odd chance mentioned her strange dreams of going to this weird future Tokyo, and they matched notes and it seemed like they were going to the same place. Absolutely bizarre. And so I'd never had a lucid dream before. I barely remember my dreams. Not really my thing. I've tried a dream diary over the years, but they never last more than a week.
It's like a week, yeah.
It's like too much work to write it down. But the other night, it was after the show on Tuesday night, the Plus show, I had a really late night and I finally get to sleep. It's like 3 a.m.
Did you take anything like melatonin?
Well, it was the first time I'd had a coffee after midday in like a year.
Yeah, and you're pretty super sensitive to caffeine.
Super sensitive to caffeine. I usually never sleep on caffeine. For some reason, I was so tired, I fell asleep, though. And I'm in this dream, and I'm walking out of an electronics store, and I come out of the store, and I'm in future Tokyo. And it's bizarre. It's like all these glowing blue and white neon signs, and there's people walking everywhere, and I just have this feeling it's like some weird future Japan.
I was going to ask you that. Like, why did you know that it was Tokyo? Was there writing that you could see, or it was just that?
I couldn't read anything.
It's
just the feeling.
Okay.
It was Japan in my mind, this knowing. And so I cross the road and I'm not lucid. This is just a dream. I'm not even lucid in this experience. And you know, when you cross the road in any country in the world, there's the sounds of the light and the little man and the sound goes off, and it's the same in Japan. There's a particular sound when you cross the road.
It's like a chirp.
I start crossing the road and all the sounds are kabuki sounds.
What?
Yeah, like kabuki sounds. Like
our soundboard.
Like this. It's like this when I'm crossing the road. And everywhere I walk, there's these little
Yeah, turn the volume down on that one.
There's these little ads everywhere, like screens with ads and rolling displays. They're all making kabuki sounds. Like everything in society is a kabuki sound. And it's so hilarious. It's so ridiculous. Like the yoi goes off. And I just start laughing in the dream. And then it occurs to me, I'm in a dream. This is a dream. And I remember that trick to look at your hands. Because we had heard that time and time again from people that have OBEs and out-of-body experiences and weird lucid dreams. You look at your hands and it's a technique to get lucid, to get focused. And for some reason it works. So I look down at my hands after having this thought and it worked. I'm just like instantly locked in. I'm instantly lucid. I've got full control. Now, for those of you listening who have had this experience, you might be thinking, well, big deal. But this has never happened to me before. This is the first time in my life I've been in control.
Well, and imagine the fact that you've suddenly realized that you're in control, you can do anything you want.
That's the first thing that occurs to my mind. It's like, I can do anything. I can go anywhere. I'm in total control of this dream.
So what
did you
do?
It's a populated street and there's people walking by. There's like a little Japanese businesswoman walks past and I start walking down the street like I'm ecstatic, looking around at all the buildings, listening to the kabuki sounds. And I pass this businessman who's going on the other side of the street. He's on the other side of the footpath. And he's a Westerner. He's wearing like a gray suit. I think he's carrying a briefcase. And I remember he kind of looks like Tom Cruise in that movie where he's like a gritty assassin with gray hair.
Okay.
He kind of looks like that. Like he's got light gray hair. And I walk past him, don't pay much attention to him. And I'm still thinking, what can I do? And I think, I'm going to fly. I can do anything. It's a lucid dream. I'm going to fly. And so I start running down the street.
Matrix style.
And I jump and I take off and I start flying and it feels incredible, right? I'm whizzing past.
Are you still in the same city?
Yeah. And after about, it would have been about 2 seconds of flying, of like ecstatic flying, something from behind crash tackles me to the ground and I feel it. Like it feels real, like something's grabbing me. And I scramble up to the ground and this businessman I'd walked past on the street is trying to choke me out. Like he's got his arms around me. He's like trying to hold me down. He's trying to get me in a headlock and choke me out. And I'm struggling with him.
It's like he's some type of guard for this dream school.
And I turn around and I make eye contact with him. And suddenly it just pops into my mind. You're an agent. Like you're
an
agent.
What are you talking? Are you high? Did you go to sleep watching The Matrix?
No, I hadn't thought about The Matrix, but it just pops into my head. I'm like, you're an agent and you're trying to stop me. And he just looks at me and continues to like choke me out.
See, the one thing that occurred to me as you were describing this is that like we've often heard about people experiencing flying dreams. It's only because I've been reading about it this week. But it's actually and they are common, but you have to be very careful for people that experience flying dreams because they're commonly associated with screen memories for abductees.
Oh, really?
Yeah, abductees commonly report that they have these flying dreams, but the flying dream is some type of...
them being whisked out.
Yeah, it's like somehow how the body somehow processes what's going on during the abduction.
The feeling I got that I was forbidden to be lucid. I wasn't permitted.
He's like a portal guardian.
It's like he wanted me to just stop. I had to stop. I wasn't permitted to experience this.
Did you engage with him? Did you talk to him?
I was struggling. I was fighting him. And I woke up. I got so excited, like the adrenaline rush, because it felt real. It was like me having a fight with you right now in this room. It felt real. And I wake up from the adrenaline surge and I'm terrified, like this feeling of immense fear. And I had to like pull the blanket up over me. I was really scared. And it doesn't make any sense. Like there was nothing super scary about the situation, but it was the feeling
afterwards. But being tackled by someone, that would cause everything
it's
to not, go.
It's like that wasn't even what I was scared about. It was something else.
No, but your adrenaline would go up. Like obviously if you're thinking that you're fighting someone and you're defending yourself, it would cause a rush of all those chemicals. So it makes sense that when you wake up, you would still have those chemicals rushing through your body.
My heart was pumping. I was sweating. You know, like what you always hear with these weird dreams. And what was interesting about it is the feeling of waking up with that terror. It was familiar. And I realized that I've woken up like that probably countless times over my life, but never remembered why. This was the first time I'd woken up and had that feeling of this fear and understood what it was connected to, because I'd never been lucid like that in a dream before. So I wondered how many times this has happened, like where I've been tackled or attacked in some dream state. But because I haven't been lucid, I don't recall it when I wake up. All I remember is this feeling of fear.
Well, it sounds like you've been suffering from night terrors, but not able to, as you're saying, able to recall what's taking place, but maybe you're going to some same space.
I don't know. So the next day I was like, it's on, let's go. Like, I'm going to go back and take him on. I haven't been able to recreate it.
Yeah, you can't. And I wonder though, you've got a question. Is it just simply because of the nature of what we've been talking about with those topics recently?
Yeah,
in fact, it's been a couple of weeks. Is that incorporated into your mind? But for you to have that experience of actually lucid dreaming, that's a little bit different. And I do question whether or not, see, when I, remember how I told you I ate a bunch of chocolate coated coffee beans?
Yeah.
And then I took a melatonin that night. And I kid you, it was DMT kind of experiences.
Wow.
And it was just simply because of the, you know, the substances that you take. Nothing that's illegal. It was just, it was this bad combination and it was nuts.
I think the coffee had something to do with it.
It does.
I can never sleep on caffeine at all. But because
well,
I was
psychoactive,
because I had a few nights with hardly any sleep, I was just so tired. I zonked out, but still with the caffeine high. And I think that's what helped. Or my theory is it's purely kabuki sounds that put you in a lucid state. So I'm gonna put together a kind of dream tape where it's just kabuki sounds that trigger in my REM state.
Again, so you probably just fell asleep with our soundboard playing. That's
three hours into my REM state, I want to hear this. And I reckon, like, I find that it's so funny. I'll just be like, I'll snap awake in the dream.
But no, that's a technique that lucid dreamers use. They use like certain audio and sounds to cause them to, you know, like they hear it externally, but it incorporates into the dream. Yeah. And that is a notice to wake up in the dream.
It's one of the lost Robert Monroe tapes, the Kabuki
edition. I'm not sure it's that, but you never know. But isn't it weird that you ended up in that kind of futuristic city?
Yeah, I mean, I've got to obviously say I was influenced, even though it had been 2 weeks since we covered that segment from, what was the name, Samantha.
Mm.
I hadn't thought about it in 2 weeks, but it is odd that I was in some weird future Tokyo.
I don't like these things, these agents.
Yeah, it felt like he was a policeman.
Well, he's a portal guardian.
And he was keeping an eye on me. Like, it's just like the Matrix. Like, he walked past appearing to be a normal guy in the world, but he wasn't. He was watching and he was making sure that I didn't take off.
I could like belittle you and make fun of you for being so scared at, you know, a man in your 40s of being, you know, waking up from a bad dream and being terrified. But that's what happened to me last night.
Really?
Yeah. But it was like, you remember I kept on saying, like, for whatever reason, and it just must be because of this sleep stages that I go through. And like, you and I haven't been sleeping and work's been crazy because our office has been,
kids are sick,
it's everything like that. But I've always had these weird sensations that there's like something standing next to the bed. And it stopped for so long. And I was like, this is awesome. Like, this is great. And like, I've stopped like reading any of this stuff outside of work. And I was like, okay, great. Last night, I have this dream that this thing is, I can't see it, but it's standing next to the bed once again. And it comes over with its finger and it just goes like that.
You couldn't see it, but you sensed a presence.
I sensed a presence, right? And it flicked my face here. And so, of course, I wake up and I'm like, my face is hurting.
Oh.
So, like, I did the same, like, pull the blanket over. I'm like,
you start crying.
Mommy.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
It's terrifying. I haven't thought about turning the light on. I'm like, should I turn the light on? But I'm like, if there's something there, I don't want to see it. I don't want to deal with it.
I think it's purely because you're in that semi-hypnagogic state that makes you so fearful.
Yeah, it really does.
It's like a physiological thing.
Yeah, it is a physiological thing. And like anything that's like rational, like, oh, come on, it's ridiculous. Like, I'm not scared of the dark. I'm not scared of anything like that. But when you're in that state, for whatever reason, it's not that you're physically vulnerable, but I think you're psychically vulnerable, which is why so many people report like the sleep paralysis experiences. It's around that time. You know, it's like, and I think that's far more dangerous than the physicality of these things, because once you're back in the full physical, if there are these entities, these non-physical entities, they can't really get to you in the physical.
Is that what you're going to be talking about today on the show?
No, actually, I'm going to be going into this really great little pamphlet that I picked up. When I say pamphlet, it's 113 pages long. But it was this publication that was put out by David Webb back in the late 1970s.
Okay.
And it's called 1973, Year of the Humanoids. And I thought, oh, hang on a second. Like, we know 1973 because we often reference the work of Stan Gordon and the great, you know, deal of research he did through Pennsylvania of this weird connection of Bigfoots being associated with UFO activity. And it really took off in 1973. Like, it was huge. Did I say 83 before? 73.
73. You said 73.
Yeah, really, really took off. But funnily enough, David Webb has done something that I really like researchers doing. He's tried to critically analyze the reports and the data and get like a map out of them, get some type of information flowing. And there's a heap of like histogram charts and stuff, which I won't bore you with. But he's found some really intriguing similarities in these cases that suggest that, yeah, this is what it is about with paranormal phenomena. Yes, it is about the stories and people having their individual experiences. And of course, we have to listen to them and, you know, we have to describe those stories. But it's also looking at the bigger picture. What the hell is going on?
I returned a UFO book I had this morning.
Did you?
Which was all about 1973.
Really? By whom?
I can't remember. It was just like a Kindle Unlimited book. I just returned it because I wasn't going to cover it on the show. But It's funny, like if you search 1973 UFO, you get all these results. Yeah. Like that was the year.
1954 was the year in France. There was the French wave. 1973 was really, I mean, even though stuff did happen globally in 1973, it was the United States and it was October of 1973, which coincides with Stan Gordon's work. A lot of that weird Bigfoot UFO ball of light activity was October of 1973.
The portals were opened.
What is it about that date?
The portals were open.
Well, maybe. So what are you going to come up with on this episode?
Well, I thought my weird lucid dream I was so excited about would be the perfect end to an amazing segment.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started to look for things that were related, you know, something we could sink our teeth into, a nice juicy story.
Well, I see you've got a Bigfoot with a taco here. So is that what you're trying to sink your teeth into, Ben?
I didn't really get any hits, you could say. I mean, we've been doing this show for how long is it now? 18 years?
I don't know.
The hits are getting rarer in terms of how many times you find something that you haven't done before. Like often I'll find a book and I'm like, this is awesome. I'll start reading the story.
I know exactly what you're going to say.
30% into the story. And I'm like, this sounds kind of familiar. It's really good. It sounds familiar though. And then I look up my notes and I did it like 12 years ago. I know the story back to front. Or I load up some book and it's got all my highlights in it.
Yeah, I do that. I like get a Kindle book and download. I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. I'm like, oh, highlight.
Like we're really at the tip of the bull's horn. We can't dig any deeper.
Guys, keep going. Keep going. No.
But occasionally you do find these diamonds amongst the rough, or you just find rough. So I found this book that was, I can't remember the name of the author because I trashed it.
Great.
It was a woman who she started having lucid dreams. And so I thought, here's my in, I can connect it. But she started having lucid dreams about Bigfoot. It all started when she had this knee injury. She did a ligament twist or something and she
Bigfoot
was...
Bigfoot attacker in the woods?
No, nothing to do with Bigfoot. She wasn't even interested in Bigfoot. And she had just was, you know, on crutches and couldn't get out of the house. And she was just getting so frustrated. She thought one day, like, I've got to get out of the house. I've got to go and just walk a little bit somehow. But it was just excruciating to move. And so what she did is she got on Google and she started to look up, how do I walk without bending my knee? And because if she bent her knee.
Yeah, I get it. I'm just thinking like.
Or no, how to walk without straightening your knee, I think it was. Anyway, she Googles it. And one of the results was about the ancestors of great apes and how they move. And so she starts reading it. And it's an article and it mentions Gigantopithecus.
Mm-hmm.
And Australopithecus, like the ancestors of the great apes.
And some us.
And some of them were supposedly bipedal. And she starts reading.
Yeah, both were.
Well, she starts reading this this article about it, and it links to another thing about Gigantopithecus. And it mentions that they could be responsible for modern-day Bigfoot sightings, that there's some kind of surviving Gigantopithecus or ancient relative. Obviously it doesn't fit in with the evidence, but that's one of the ideas, that it's this surviving population. And so she reads it and she's like, oh, that's really interesting. Now I know the answer to Bigfoot. That's cool. And just like, okay. And that also tells me this technique so I can walk and not be in as much pain. So that afternoon she drives to the mall and she tries this new walking technique she's learned from the internet. And it works. She gets about 30 feet from her car and she's like, this is actually working. She's got this weird gait going, but it's working. Until she gets to about 35 feet into the mall and there's this, and she's like, she's in so much
pain. It's like
pain.
Those gym videos you see where it goes,
She's in so much pain. She can barely move. And all she thinks is, I've got to make it back to the car. Like, please God help me. I've got to make it back to the car. But she can't. She can't move. She's just collapsed on the floor. She's in so much pain. She feels some force unseen come and lift her up. Like,
she's subtly here.
Yeah, come from underneath her arms and like give her support. And she starts kind of semi-walking, semi-gliding back to the car. And she can't understand what, she can feel something touching her shoulders. She looks, there's no one there.
But like
she
a third man effect.
Yeah, she can feel someone lifting her up. She looks, there's no one there. And she's about 10 feet from her car and she looks down because she can feel something swishing beside her legs. And she looks down and she claims she sees two sets of thin, hairy legs walking beside her. Just the legs, like they stop at the hips. And they got big feet and they're like walking next to her. And it suddenly clicks. She's like, This is somehow Bigfoot.
Oh my God.
Bigfoot is helping me get back to my car.
Let's look what's happened. For whatever reason, she's gone and Googled how to walk like a tard, and it's given her this Australopithecus and Gigantopithecus. And she's like, oh, that answers Bigfoot. We'll put that to the side. And then yet somehow this invisible Bigfoot is now carrying her.
Well, it turns into a full-on psychic Bigfoot contactee experience where he's showing up in her bedroom at night. She can see him, but the husband can't see him. The husband's really supportive. He's like, whatever you say, honey, I believe it.
So, tell me. So she obviously, he gets her back into the car. And she drives home.
Yeah, she drives home. She doesn't know what it is. She starts to get really involved in the Bigfoot scene. Like, she goes to conferences. She starts reading alternative Bigfoot books that talk about them being the forest people and being psychic.
So she's reading a lot of Kawani Lapsarukas.
Yeah, she hires a psychic and the psychic's like, oh, they want to make contact with you. Like, all the usual stuff. And her house is just plagued with poltergeist stuff. Like, it's just a pure poltergeist experience, but she's just convinced it's Bigfoot. And ultimately I didn't cover it because the big coup de grace, the big reveal at the end, like the pinnacle of the story is that this ghost Bigfoot reunites her with her dead cat, a ghost cat. And this is like, this is meant to be the whoa part of the story. So I, naturally my face when that happened was like, whoa, wow. This is a banger for the show. So at this stage, I'm hours into this story thinking, where do we actually go from here? But yeah, that was the big reveal. So I get to work. I drive into work, right? And today, man, you know how you're trying to read, you're trying to concentrate, and any little noise just throws you
out? Yeah, I can't function with any noise.
I get into work, and these effers over here behind you, Aaron, on the other side.
Yep.
They're doing renovations today. And so the entire morning is bang, 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 zoo, 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 bang, 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 rock music going.
Oh, this studio has been the biggest mistake.
Oh.
Biggest mistake ever.
So I'm like, I've got to go to the library or something. This is just insane. I can't work here. So I go to the local library. I go to the Maroochydore Library.
Oh, that would have been fun. Was it a bit methy?
Yeah. It's like you look up the reviews for the Maroochydore Library and most of them say, it's really good, but you might have a crackhead ask you for spare change.
It's right near the courthouse.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. So it's like you just get like, oh, yeah, I cut my car cut off because I was drink driving again. I'm like, oh, my God.
A couple of the reviews were from young women who said there's creepy old men that crack onto you and try and touch you. So other than that, it's a really good experience. But I did find this book on the shelf. Where is it? Oh,
what the?
Not sinking. Why isn't it sinking?
No, but the image that came up that people could.
Oh, there.
What? No. What's this other image you've got? What the hell is going on with you?
Well, it's from this book, 100 Weirdest Tales from Across Australia. I'm like, sweet. Thanks, Ben. Ben Pobgy has saved me. And I was looking through. It's like the usual stuff we would expect. It's got the big cat.
Emu War.
Big cat stories. Emu War. Thank you. It's got haunted Australian shits that you've covered a billion times. Yowie stories, you know, a billion things that we've seen before. And then I get to this chapter entitled The Perplexity of the Poo Jogger. Do you know this story?
I do know this story.
This is from Brisbane. I didn't even know this story.
I do know this story.
The Poo Jogger.
Yep.
So Andrew Douglas McIntosh of Greenslopes, Brisbane will forever go down in history as the man who made Greenslopes a little less green. Andrew McIntosh was a silver fox of 64 years with a good job at a major retirement village company. He had a place on the infrastructure board at the Brisbane City Council. And
well, that explains everything.
Ben writes that many in such a comfortable position live out their lives quietly playing by the rules, refusing to make a splash or rock the boat for fear of threatening their cushy bourgeoisie existence. Andrew McIntosh was not such a man. He felt himself chafing at the bonds in which middle-class Western civilization had ensnared him. So here is a guy who is a revolutionary at heart, but as Ben writes, constrained by the norms of Western civilization.
And pants, apparently.
But one day on his morning jog, he had a slight urge to go, and he saw a brand new apartment building that had just been constructed. And he realized that there was a temptation burning inside him. And much like, you know, Bilbo in The Hobbit, he said, why shouldn't I? And he took a massive dump on that that particular apartment building. And that wasn't the last time he did it. He loved it so much. He really enjoyed it. Every single morning after that, he would go on a jog in the morning and he would take a dump on a different brand new apartment building in Brisbane.
There must be something psychosexual or something going on here, because why do you, I get it. I've heard, like, have you heard of the runner shits?
Yeah.
It's like people, like you see.
But he's just going for a 30-minute jog.
That go, no, well, yeah, but there are people that do marathons and they literally shit their pants from the physical exertion, right? But it, clearly this guy just couldn't hold on for 15 minutes and has gone, oh, desecrating this new building has just somehow excited me. I'm going to do it to every building I can find.
Yeah, he did it so often that the media dubbed him the poo jogger. And no one could catch him. Police were on the lookout. No one could catch the guy. He was doing it at different times, hitting a different building every week.
And poop is really hard to get DNA out of.
So, is it?
Yeah, it's really hard. Okay. So it's like,
and so basically all these buildings that were being affected by the poo jogger, they had stakeouts. Like there was a community effort to stake out and try and catch him. And one day they caught him. They got him. McIntosh was taken into custody, given a hefty fine, lost his job, and subsequently never poo jogged again. And that's when I realized that Maroochydore Library is not the hot spot to get banger stories. It's not the best place to get the best stories. I'd never heard of the poo jogger.
There was one in Sydney too.
Was there?
Yeah, there was one in Sydney and she kept on like, you know in Sydney how you've got like all those laneways?
Mm.
So she would just get up in the morning, go another jogger would go for a run, poop in the laneway, and it was only after they set up cameras that they're able to catch her. And it was near where you and I used to be. It was just St. Leonard's.
Did you see the guy in Sydney who was just going for a swim?
No.
There was this couple, this family, they had a pool in their backyard and they, on their camera.
Oh, I did see that.
Guy would just come and go for a swim in their pool.
Yep.
You know, and you just do it every afternoon.
Rather than complaining about it and giving it to the media, put a lock on your gate.
Put a toaster in there.
Okay, I don't think electrocuting someone is probably appropriate. It's probably not proportionate.
Well, it is appropriate for this show because obviously I couldn't finish on the poo jogger, a bit of a throwaway story.
To be honest, Ben, you couldn't really start on the poo jogger.
So I started to look around for something else. I needed more. And
this looks more Asian coming.
I liked the segment you did on the Last Plus show on the classic story of Jeff the Talking Mongoose.
Mm-hmm.
And while you were talking about that segment, this famous case of this family that had poltergeist activity, but they saw this strange spirit that appeared as a weasel or a mongoose. Some of them described it as a weasel. And as you were describing that, it made me think of the classic yellow weasel from Chinese mythology.
Right. Well, you were referencing the idea that's like the kitsune or the fox spirit. You know, these are low-level entities which you have to beware of. And so that particular weasel, the yellow weasel.
The yellow weasel.
Is one of these dangerous entities that you should be fearful of.
Supposedly the most associated with spirit possession in East Asia. And we've covered a bunch of the kitsune and, you know, fox spirits possessing people in these older and new stories, new experiences from the East. I wanted to investigate this a little bit more, and I found this post from a prolific Reddit poster who we've covered a couple of times in the past, Moondog151, he goes by. He's a Canadian guy, I believe. And most of his posts are true crime stories, but he's done a couple of paranormal ones over the years. Remember the guy who... He was in a Chinese village and he just went to sleep one night and woke up like 3 hours train ride away in a different city in China. He was teleporting in his sleep.
Oh, yes, I do. Yeah.
And ultimately, we discovered that it was two strange immortals that would appear to him.
And take him flying
at night. And a lot of this was verified by police reports. He would turn up.
Well, he was a farmer, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a farmer. He would turn up in cities that were impossible for him to get to in the amount of time he traveled.
Right.
Even with high-speed rail, which wasn't there at the time.
Also, because of the draconian sort of citizen monitoring as well, you know, there would be a record of him utilizing their public transport network, and there wasn't.
I remember even if he caught a plane, he still couldn't have got to this other city in time. So it was a real mystery, a couple of great cases like that. And I came across this fairly recent post he did on what I'll call the Wu family incident. And it reminded me of this, you know, topic Jeff. We've been talking about, Jeff the Talking Mongoose and this idea of possession. So this goes back to April the 11th, 2005 in Taiwan. There was a man named Wu Shan. He's left his home in the Gushan district in Kaohsiung in Taiwan. It was notable that he had come out of his home because he and his entire family had become complete recluses over the last couple of weeks. No one had seen this guy or any family member leave the house in over a month, actually. When he finally did step outside, he looked completely changed. He was disheveled. He was emaciated.
Were they eating? Well, I guess if you're not going out.
He wasn't. Mm. He walked up to a neighbor straight away. And without any explanation, he just said, "The home. Go inside the home." He added, "Call an ambulance." And he just walked away. It's like he was in shock. He didn't say who the ambulance was for. He didn't offer any more details to this neighbor. So obviously the neighbor's like, "This is bizarre. I've got to go and check this guy's house. So the neighbor that she enters the residence, which I've got on the screen here, it's just this little, duplex. And the neighbor goes in and immediately it just reeks of rot in there. It didn't take long before the neighbor found 28-year-old Wu Jing, who was the eldest daughter of the family, lying on the floor. They claimed they could see foam around her mouth. Her body had already gone stiff.
She was in rigor mortis.
Yeah. So
she'd been there for how long?
The neighbor calls the police. They summon an ambulance, but obviously, it's too late. Like
12 hours.
She's stiff. She was pronounced dead at the scene. But at the hospital, they do a forensic examination. She's been dead for 2 days. Her body showed signs of prolonged abuse. She was covered in bruises. She had burn scars. More shockingly, her mouth, esophagus, and stomach were filled with human feces. The cause of death was listed as multiple organ failure due to prolonged starvation. The bruises were extensive, but they weren't severe enough to be the cause of death. It wasn't huge hits with a blunt object or anything.
So what was it?
Well, some of them appeared self-inflicted, some of these wounds.
But what did she die from?
Well, no one from the family came to claim the body. I think she'd just been dead from starvation. That was the initial ruling. But no one from the family came to claim the body. The hospital tried to contact the relatives. They couldn't get through to anyone. So it wasn't until April the 13th that the police got back on the case. They suspected abuse and feared that the rest of the family were on the run. So investigators start interviewing the neighbors and the hospital staff, and a picture begins to form of what took place. The Wu family had become reclusive shortly after moving into the home, and no one in the neighborhood had seen them outside since. The injuries to Jing's body could not all be self-inflicted because many of them were consistent with beatings. So someone was beating her up. When police enter the home, again, this foul stench is in every room. Thick curtains are blocking out all the sunlight. The windows are all shut tight. There's no fresh air in there. And there's a shrine to the third prince, a Taoist deity, in the living room, surrounded by all these weird statues. There's these strange talismans I've got on the screen here that are above every single window, which might be reasonably common in some East Asian households. It's like you're warding off spirits or something. But in the context of this scenario, it's especially weird. They had these scrolls and other talismans on all the windows as well. So police interview the neighbors and they start to describe this family. So Sean, the father, he's in his 50s. He lived with his wife and they had four adult children, three daughters, one son. Wu Jing, the girl that died, the body they found, she was the eldest. She had graduated and moved to Beijing. And later she opened a bento shop, lived with a boyfriend. Her siblings remained in their hometown, Kaohsiung. One son worked at a factory. The other two daughters were both nurses. Pretty normal situation. At the end of February 2005, Jing suddenly returned to Taiwan from Beijing. Less than a month later, the entire family started acting strangely. This is what the neighbors said. The family just got weird when the eldest daughter came back from China. Neighbors noticed their behavior deteriorating. Even extended relatives kind of cut contact with them because they were acting a bit bizarre. Once the case hit the news, though, all five family members turned themselves in. They went to the Kaohsiung District Prosecutor's Office. They were all questioned. The story is when they were questioned by the police, they all said the same thing. They said, our sister or our daughter, Wu Jing, isn't dead. What died was the demon possessing her. So, okay, nice excuse.
Well, her body would say otherwise.
Believing the family might be inventing a bizarre story to avoid accountability, as you would, the police start separating all the family members. They start interrogating them separately. The investigators notice something striking. Each family member has similar bruises. Like, up their arms, on their chest, their faces are marked. Nearly identical to the kind of wounds that were on the woman that died, Wu Jing. Obvious signs of abuse on all of them. Shan and his wife, Yang Ying, had always lived in this area in Kaohsiung. They worked manual labor jobs. But unlike their parents, their four children were well-educated, held good jobs. Neighbors recalled the family as very normal. They were a little bit superstitious, but so are a lot of people in Taiwan. I mean, they had the...
Of course, yeah.
They had the shrine and all that sort of stuff. But the shrine they had was a little weird. They had a shrine to the third prince, Nei Jia.
What's wrong with that?
Well, Nei Jia, I think I've mentioned Nei Jia on the show before because it's one of my favorite ancient Chinese legends. And here's on the screen, that's the statue there. That's the shrine, right? They had all these other unknown ones, but that was the main shrine. So they don't have a Buddha or anything. They don't have the usual Guan Yin or anything like that. They got this Nei Jia. So Nei Jia, this kid was born during the Shang dynasty. His father was a military commander, Li Jing, famous military commander. The story is his mother got pregnant with him. And after 9 months, you know, she was showing the big bump, she was still pregnant. And after 18 months, she was still pregnant. And after 24 months, she was still pregnant. Finally, after 3 years and 6 months, she finally gives birth. And what comes out is a giant slimy flesh ball.
This is very
similar.
I do remember this story. And it also reminds me actually of what we were just talking about with possessions last week. And I was referencing that work of the psychosexual activities of occult, which is, I can't remember exactly what the book was. Remember how I was telling you the stories of women that thought that they were copulating with like demons and
Satan. I forgot to look that
up. Entities, yeah. And that she was, that's your show content for today, Ben, not go to the library. But regardless, if you recall, it was believed that they were copulating with corpses and demons, but then they realized it was something like an instrument. It was a machine of some kind. There's other stories in there that describe women that get pregnant, right? But they get impregnated by like a demonic force or an entity. And they have it for a certain amount of time and then the entity comes back and then the entity, like they have some vision and it leaves and they're no longer pregnant.
Mm.
Except they had like physical presentation of pregnancy and then suddenly it's like they weren't pregnant at all.
Well, it's like the father, Li Jing, he had heard your segment and he knew all these stories. So as soon as he sees his wife give birth to a giant pink slimy flesh ball, he gets his sword out and he thinks it's a demon. So he goes to slice it and he does
sounds
it perfect.
Like it's it just actually sounds like though it's a growth or it's like a fibroid or something. And
it was huge according to the story.
Yeah, but like they've misinterpreted something which is very much biological.
Well, he chops it open. A fully formed 13-year-old boy jumps out.
Okay, that's not a fibroid.
He's like,
or anything similar.
He's like, ha-ha, he jumps out. And he's fully formed. And apparently, according to the legend, he's glowing with divine energy, right? His name's Nei Jia. And the story goes that he's it's like similar to what you're describing, but he's not a spawn of demon copulation. He's a spawn of divine energy. It's like some higher being decided to place him in the egg and put him in his mother. So he ends up being trained by some Taoist master. And according to the story, he had all these supernormal abilities. Like he had fire wheels that he could spin on his feet and it allowed him to fly. There's all these cool stories. That's why I love it. It's a great, great legend. And he ends up battling one of the dragon kings.
Why would they have a statue of such a deity in their home?
See, I don't know. Like, why do you worship Nei Jia? Is he considered a fertility god because he comes out of an egg?
Or is he a protector?
Well, yeah, he's like some kind of warrior protector. Anyway, that's, I just thought I should tell the background between, because people look at this statue and think, what is that? But yeah, that's the story of Najjar. What's going on with my mouse today? So this all goes back. So all of this change to the family before, you know, the eldest sister, the eldest daughter was dead. Something happened in February of 2005. The youngest daughter, Wu Ling, suddenly came to her mother and said, "Mother, I'm no longer myself. I'm possessed by Najjar, this entity from the statue they worship." She says, "Mother, he's controlling me." And she starts to speak to her mother, but this weird male voice comes out of her, this kind of deeper, gruff voice. It says, "Your eldest daughter, Wu Jing, is in grave danger. She must return to Kaohsiung by February 28th or she will die." And so the mother, obviously worshipping this being and believing in all this, is immediately terrified, obviously believes the entity. The entire family travel to Taipei to retrieve Jing. And they track it down. You know, she's running her business. And they track it down and says, "Listen, a spirit possessed your sister. It's Najjar. The third prince says you're facing catastrophe. You have to come back with us or you're going to die." So you'd think she'd be skeptical. She's got her whole life in Taipei. She's got her business going. She's got her boyfriend there. But she's been brought up in this household that worships Najjar. So she's like, all right.
It's time to go.
Drop everything. She leaves her boyfriend. She leaves her business. Drops her entire life. Moves back to her hometown with her parents and moves into the home. Now, her
mental...
They've
been waiting to hear.
As soon as she moves in, her mental health just rapidly deteriorates. She starts having vivid, lucid dreams. She believes she's being sexually assaulted in these dreams. She becomes too afraid to sleep at night. She rests during daylight hours or tries to sleep during daylight hours when everyone else is, you know, awake and up. Now, naturally, the family sought out a Taoist priest because they want to remove this possessing spirit that's taken over the eldest daughter. They still believe that this Najjar is protecting them and had warned them about a real dangerous demon. So the Taoist priest comes, they do this ceremony. It seems to work for a few days, but then the nightmares continue.
But this really reinforces what we were talking about last week with this idea that you perform an exorcism and then you give yourself over to this higher power. And this is what this family's doing. They go, oh, it's something that we worship. It's something that we revere. It's going to protect us. When it clearly is an entity masquerading,
yeah,
pretending.
The whole thing sounds like a setup from the get-go. And it's like, she was fine, but now she's entered the domain of this spirit that gave the message in the first place. And she's being attacked. So,
and physicality, is as much as it sounds to be silly, it's like, because there can be shared psychotic breaks. Mm. Like families can, but it's rare, right? But that can occur. But also in demonology, it seems like physical presence makes a big difference as well.
It's if you're within the field of this entity, you're vulnerable. Yeah, it certainly seems to be the case. Well, she starts to grow disheveled. She's not sleeping properly. She's not eating properly. She looks withdrawn. She looks like her energy is being sapped.
Well, if there really is an entity, of course the energy is being sapped.
In early March, the family said they got this strange phone call and the eldest daughter answered and then had a strange look on her face and then hung up. No one knows what the call was. No one knows who was on the other end. But after she received this phone call, she declared herself to be Bodhisattva Guan Yin, like the goddess of mercy, like one of the main higher beings of the pantheon.
Well, it's kind of the equivalent of someone like putting the phone down and saying, well, I'm now the reincarnation of Jesus.
Yeah, or the Virgin Mary or something, right? She has used the eldest daughter's human form to descend to earth. So this is when she starts self-harming. She starts striking herself, hitting herself with a broom, like jabbing herself with sharp instruments. After this, the entire family becomes possessed. Every single one of them, one after the other.
With what, different entities or the same entities?
Yeah, so the father declares himself as the Jade Emperor. He now has the Jade Emperor inside his body to try and combat this evil spirit. The wife, Yang Ying, a few days later, she claims she has the Queen Mother of the West inside her, controlling her. The next day, the daughter, Wu Qian, calls her the second daughter. She calls herself one of the seven fairies. One of these are the daughters of the Jade Emperor. She's one of them. The son, feeling left out, claims he's the Taoist master. Where is he? Monk Jigong. He's possessed as well. The entire family is possessed. They all believe the house is filled with demonic energy, and the divine spirits that have now possessed them are there to battle the evil within.
Did anyone ever check for like a mold outbreak in the home?
Yeah, it's funny.
Is there something in the water?
That's what everyone says. It's like, okay, so there's some kind of
food,
gas leak. Yeah, some kind of mold poisoning. Nothing was revealed. Like, no, I don't know if tests were done in that vein. You would expect something like that would be pretty obvious.
Well, and you would imagine with the daughter who sadly died, there would be toxicology that would be run. So surely that would show up, you know, most substances.
No mention of that. From early March to April, this delusion consumes the entire household. The family believed violent exorcisms were necessary to combat this evil. So because they all believe each other is possessed by demonic energy, they're all trying to exorcise each other at random intervals.
So is this the infliction of bruising? Yeah.
They do this by throwing rice and salt at each other, which you can see in this image on the screen.
Oh, a wonderful recreation there, Ben.
They beat one another with brooms, crutches, mops, even ancestral tablets from their home shrine they used to crack each other's skull with.
Effective.
Eventually, they begin stabbing each other with burning incense sticks to get rid of the demons.
Works every time.
Weirdly, none of this works. Wu Jing, who had first shown signs of possession, was seen as carrying the most demonic energy, so she endured the worst abuse, which is, you know, probably the girl in yellow on the screen there. She wasn't allowed to eat afternoon, could only drink water, and was limited to just a few hours of sleep each day. Their behavior continued to spiral. They stopped working, rarely left the house. So this is when the neighbors notice, okay, when they're not coming out, we haven't seen them in weeks. They only wore black clothing because they believed the black fabric would absorb the yin, absorb the evil energy. And so the neighbors took pictures because they would dry all their clothing they hung up to dry was all these black cloaks and black hoodies and stuff.
They're just hanging out with Kanye West.
It's weird, isn't it? When not worn, the garments were hung over the balcony. Talismans, again, covered every window. And they burned gold paper daily at the doorway. So they're going all out to try and stop these spirits. And the neighbors could hear them. It was like a kung fu movie in there every day.
Look, why is the neighbors, though, why are they not contacting the authorities or reporting it to someone?
You don't want to get involved in other people's business.
Well, I know you don't want to, but if you see an entire family starting to behave in a very erratic fashion.
But they're not seeing them. They're just
It just said they're burning paper at the door every morning.
Just superstitious. Apparently, the neighbors could hear them. It was like kicking and punching and fighting. So, yeah, maybe they should call the police. One night, Sean wandered, this is the father, he wandered to a neighbor's door, rambling incoherently. He declared himself the Jade Emperor to the neighbors.
Okay, that's also a point where it's maybe you should contact someone.
Well, his daughter dragged him back inside, beating and kicking him and punching him on the way back in. So maybe the neighbors thought, well, everything's under control here. The neighbors, terrified they might be the next demon, chose not to intervene. So that's the example. That's the answer. They didn't want to get possessed as well, so best to stay away from the demon-possessed family. The diet became even more disturbing. They stopped eating regular food, convinced it was tainted by demons. Instead, they smeared one another in their own feces and urine, forcing each other to ingest it. The reasoning was they believed this would disgust the spirits enough to leave their bodies.
So that Brisbane pooping guy really was just the equivalent of like Uber Eats.
Yeah, dude. You see how everything connects?
It makes all sense.
You
absolutely
see how masterfully planned
I can tell.
This entire segment was from start to finish? Wu Jing consumed the most feces, which is why they found it, you know, in her system in the autopsy. Even the extended relatives noticed something was wrong because Jing, I think that's the wife, visited the aunt's home, one of the aunt's homes, to perform an exorcism. But on the way there, she was apparently like spitting and kicking at strangers on the street.
Which is what demonic possessions do in the West.
I mean,
they spit.
Everyone's asking about mold and ergot poisoning. I'm like, how about demon possession? Well, I don't know. That seems like the obvious thing that's going on.
I'm not familiar with Taiwanese culture. Do they recognize demonic possession?
Yeah, of course. Of course, yeah, spirit possession. So by April the 9th, Wu Jing had been starved, beaten, sleep-deprived for nearly a month. That night, she collapsed onto her bed, foaming at the mouth, her heartbeat faint. Now, the two sisters, who were both nurses, when their sister lost consciousness, for some reason, they snapped out of it. It's like they were momentarily with it. They got their right mind back, and they attempted CPR. They tried to revive her, but she died. And after she died, the family just went on with life. Just left the body there and went on with their normal routine.
Well, whether it's a psychotic break or a demonic possession, it's really, you know, two of the same, because they're not going to be rational and go, oh, there's a dead body in the house, we should do something.
Well, it was rational in a way because they still believed that the body had a demon inside it, and so they didn't want to touch it because the demon would then jump out.
But then you have to question why. I mean, I know that they got in a Taoist priest earlier, but if you've got a demonic body lying in front of you, wouldn't you contact some type of, another Taoist?
Well, it was like the daughter dying snapped the father out of it. It's like he gained control momentarily, and that's when he's kind of stumbled out and told the neighbors to go inside. So it took him 2 days to kind of come out and do something about it. So police obviously arrange psychiatric evaluations.
And what did that determine?
That they're all totally fine. No signs of psychosis.
See, again, that's what Ed and Lorraine Warren were talking about in the number of times that they dealt with demonic possession cases. One of their first approaches was to ensure that the person is not suffering from some type of psychotic condition. Yeah. And 9 times out of 10, they weren't.
No signs of mental illness, you know, nothing in their history. Not even extended family members had history of mental illness. Well, it just wasn't there.
That's not to say necessarily that perhaps, you know, they've had an environmental exposure to something. And that's where it comes back to.
Sure.
Yeah, mold, contaminants.
Well, they said there was no medical defense. So you would think that would have come up.
Been checked.
Right. Police charged the family with abandoning a helpless person resulting in death. After their arrest, the neighbors returned and pulled their funds for a Taoist priest to cleanse the house and the entire neighborhood. So it's like everyone around them,
it's a big job,
believed it was some kind of spirit possession. The court delivered the verdict on April the 12th, 2007, not guilty. They're all
through
not guilty.
Through what means? Because obviously it can't be through means of mental deficiency.
They ruled mass hysteria. So it's like
a temporary psychosis.
Yeah. Which again, you're just like, well, spirit possession makes the most sense.
When viewed through that lens, it reminds me of that story of, was it the Trump family here in Australia?
And if you were. Yeah, wasn't that weird?
That was weird. And it was like, it made national headlines and they wanted their privacy afterwards. But from what I recall, the reason why it got so much attention is because they just seemingly all got into their car one day and took off.
Yeah, left all their mobile phones.
Everything.
Left
like
their wallets.
Meals.
Like hot meals still sitting on the kitchen table.
And then
got in the car and just started driving.
Yeah,
the whole family.
Weird cross-country kind of crazy trip.
And didn't stop driving. No. And didn't a couple of family members like throw their phones out the window as they were going?
And it was like they were being pursued by something. Yeah. We thought maybe it was gang stalking or something. But now when you hear cases like this and I go, well, clearly this is like some sudden, you know, shared psychotic episode. But is there more to it? Is there something spiritual attached to it?
We never got any answers.
Never.
And they obviously didn't want to talk to any press. So they just said, leave us alone. It's the same with this Wu family. They just said, we don't want to talk about it. Give us our privacy.
In that case, if I recall correctly, also the reason why it came about was because one of the daughters, I think, kind of snapped out of it.
Mm.
It's like, and it's the same thing.
What are we doing?
Yeah, why are we doing this?
And didn't she call the police from a gas station like 3 states away or something, half the way across the country?
That's right, yeah.
It's
very similar. There's lots of parallels in
that. Luckily, no one got killed.
Yeah.
That's the difference. They didn't throw rice and poop at each other. They didn't fully get their... They didn't fully get their privacy in the end because they made a movie about it. It's called Incantation. I thought I had an image of it, but I don't have an image of the poster. Oh, there it is. I do have it. Yeah, they made a movie about it. It's on Netflix. And they made a video game about it as well. So I don't know if they got their privacy. Apparently, it's one of the most well-known mass hysteria cases in Taiwan. There's all these people that say, well, have their own takes on what happened. The mold poisoning idea is very popular, but obviously the angle from the film is that it's a full-on demonic possession, which is what I'm leading to. It's what I'm leaning to. I think it's a real possibility. Especially because they're just, that's their thing. They're worshipping the statue. It's, you worship a statue and a spirit gets on it. Don't know what you're worshipping. You don't know what you're paying your...
I don't think it was that though, because you said something that just really rung a bell with me, and was that the daughter had gone, she'd gone to Beijing or Shanghai, or she'd gone to China, was it to study?
Yeah.
And she came
home.
Opened
a business.
Opened a business, right? Yeah, sorry. Even though they were being told to go and get it, did she bring something back with her, or did she permit access to something?
Well, remember, it was the youngest daughter who initially said, "Mom, I'm possessed. We need to bring back the eldest. We need to bring back my sister because she's possessed."
Okay.
She said, "I'm possessed by Najjar, the guardian deity that we worship every day."
I really wonder, we won't get the information, but I do wonder, what was the initiator? What did she do? Was she performing some type of divination practice?
Everything they were doing was some kind of weird occult, Eastern occultism. But I mean, that's kind of normal to a degree.
Well, if you recall, it was like the story of Robbie, which was the, the premise for The Exorcist.
Right.
It was because he'd been taught how to use an Ouija board by his aunt.
Right.
So I'm like, young girl, once again, it's like a young girl connected to poltergeist cases. And
I just find it a very weird deity to make your main point of worship.
Well, that's what I'm suggesting.
Bodhisattva of compassion. I get Buddha, obviously.
Guan Yin.
Even the cat with the arm. even that's better. The Najjar, who came out of a slimy flesh egg. That's the guy that you worship every day. You leave out your little fruits and incense for him. The fleshy egg guy.
It's strange.
It is a bit strange. So I want Moondog, always with the great stories. And I just wanted to mention one more, which isn't super paranormal, but I thought this is an incredible story. It's also from Taiwan. This one occurred in October of 2004. Rail workers in Taiwan's Taitung County made a chilling discovery. An iron derailer block, so one of these objects that's used specifically to derail a train, had been placed on the Jia He Tunnel, and they spray painted on the tunnel "hate." And the train.
What, a terrorist group?
Well, no, they just spray painted "hate." So the train didn't derail, but then 2 months later, on December the 21st, this time near Naisha Station in the country, there were fasteners securing the rails that had been deliberately damaged. And 2 days after that, graffiti appeared saying, "Hate, hate. The one stealing the rails is Jin Da Xing Engineering," some kind of local company. Emergency repairs followed, but then there was more sabotage. June the 21st, 2005, a train finally derailed near Naisha. Thankfully, no cars overturned, injuries were minor, and again, it was confirmed that one of the rail joints had been tampered with. So there's some serious sabotage going on. In August, a few months later, an electrical cable was slashed with a blade. In September, 70 rail clips were destroyed. Another message was left behind: "We steal things for Jian Da Xing Engineering. Why don't you arrest them? ? Very strange. And this graffiti that blamed this engineering company is a real company. Investigators obviously zeroed in on this company. They had recently let go 40 workers and they had a labor dispute. So the police...
Oh, so it was disgruntled workers.
Yeah, but it's almost like, why? That's what they really wanted them to think.
Mm.
You know, it's a little bit suspicious. It's a little bit suspicious that they're just... Like if you were one of these workers and you just put a big banner that says, "It's one of us," obviously, you're going to get caught. Why would they do that?
Yeah, you wouldn't do that.
Doesn't make sense. But all the former employees of this engineering company, they all had alibis during these sabotage dates, so they were fine. Then came the night of March 17, 2006. A passenger train departed Taitung New Station, and exactly 9:46 p.m., just after exiting one of the tunnels, the train derailed. Wow. Cars 1 through 5 stayed on the rails. Car 6 derailed but remained upright. Cars 7 through 10 tumbled over the 10-meter embankment, which is what you can see on the screen there. I think I got another image.
There are obviously injuries, but were there any mortalities?
No, it's no serious injuries.
Wow.
It's amazing. Everyone was fine. A few bumps and bruises. And they're like, "Everyone's fine." And then they found her. They found
Who?
One woman. She was unconscious in car 7. Her name was Chen Tai Hong Tran, she's a young Vietnamese woman. She had married a Taiwanese railway worker named Li Shuang Chuan in 2003. She'd been planning to fly back to Vietnam the next day. Her husband and his brother, Li Tai'an, were both on the train. That's her in the image there. And that's her husband and that's the brother. So they're on this train. She's the only...
Is that the guy that tackled you?
Yeah. No, the guy that tackled me was a Westerner.
Ah.
He was a Westerner. Oddly, neither man tried to rescue her. Neither man had tried to help her.
Oh, this isn't some weird murder case, is it? Attempted murder.
At the hospital, Fran regained consciousness briefly. She complained of dizziness, but within hours, her condition worsened bizarrely. By 4:15 a.m. the next day, she was dead. Her injuries didn't match the crash. She didn't die from the train crash. She had no fractures. She had no bleeding. She had a really suspicious internal hemorrhage, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong. Despite all this, police still ruled her death an accident, right?
She was involved in an accident, so.
They wanted to wrap it up. That changed when investigators realized that this was the second derailment that Tran, her husband, and the brother, Shan Chuan, had both survived. The first one had occurred on June the 21st, 2005. And there was more. Chang Chuan had previously been married to another Vietnamese woman, Pham Thai Giao Nhu, who also died mysteriously days after their wedding.
In a train derailment?
Cause of death? Snake bite. Weird.
Look, I know people are unlucky, but you have to wonder that that's more than a coincidence.
What does a snake bite cause?
What do you mean?
Internal hemorrhaging?
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole, it depends. It depends on what the snake, the toxin is. It can cause clotting. It can cause, disseminated intravascular coagulation. So basically your blood clots and thins at the same time.
Her husband, from this previous Vietnamese wife, collected 6 million yuan in insurance.
Oh, it's an insurance scheme.
Suspicious, a family friend confronted the brother. Tai'an allegedly replied, "She's already cremated. What are you going to do about it?" Good answer, bro. On March 19th, 2006, prosecutors learned that Shangguan had taken out a 76 million yuan travel accident only life insurance on his wife Tran just 6 months after marrying her.
It's pure evil. It's absolute pure evil, not just for the fact that, you know, they were trying to kill her. That's dreadful. And they killed her. That's dreadful.
How do you think you're going to get away with it when the insurance is like, okay, I want insurance, but only train derailment insurance.
Yeah.
Nothing else.
And also, though, how many people's lives did you put at risk, you scumbags?
When his previous wife died, he demanded immediate cremation.
Of course he did.
No repatriation to the family. When this new wife died, guess what he demanded? Immediate cremation.
Mm-hmm. But obviously, they didn't get that.
The autopsy ordered without his consent found traces of ipratropium, FM2, and several unknown anticoagulant agents in her blood.
She bled out.
Yeah, she'd been poisoned. On March the 23rd, police arrived at Shangguan's home to bring him in for questioning while they followed his brother sneaking out the side.
Oh, so it wasn't a snake bite, the first one. It was like because like it sounds like they're using warfarin or blood thinners.
Yeah, I thought the second one was a snake bite as well, but maybe
he
found that the snake bite initially was a little bit too complicated, maybe hard to obtain.
No, what I'm saying is he probably just injected her with something and said it was a snake bite.
Yeah, so they say there's eyewitnesses that claim that when she was in the hospital trying to get over the train crash, he tried to get in to see her.
Yeah.
And apparently he convinced and basically broke through the medical team that was there and he had like a few minutes alone with her. So they say that he must have poisoned her when she was in the hospital. He had access to her IV. So the police go to arrest the guy. He's dead. He'd committed suicide. He was hanging from a banyan tree nearby and that's his brother there next to the tree where they found him.
Because he knew he was caught.
Well, he left behind several notes. One note said, "I deeply loved my wife. I believe the autopsy will clear my name." And he said, "I hate the railway saboteur. I hope they die in hell." the public turned on the media and police. So the public believed this was them being wrongly persecuted, that these two brothers had been framed by the cops. They just wanted to get them for something. I don't think anyone knew the details of his previous wife dying from the snake bite.
Yeah. And as far as I'm aware, I have a friend who his father used to be a long time ago in the Taiwanese police. It's kind of like what happened here in Australia back in the 80s. Like there was corruption and, too much power. But all of that got washed out. Like there's oversight bodies and a whole heap of things now. So it's like I doubt that the police would go to this effort of framing this guy and derailing a train.
Who knows what things were like back in 2006. So the police go and comb through this guy's computer, the Sheng Chuan, the guy that killed himself. They find all these Google searches on snake venom.
Yeah, of course.
Poison.
Yeah.
How can I poison my wife and make it look like an accident in a train derailment? Then there was a huge breakthrough. This third man came forward. His name was Huang Fu Lai, and he made a deal with the prosecutors in exchange for full immunity. He confessed that Sheng Chuan, the husband, had orchestrated all the derailments to murder his wife Tran and make it look like an accident, which is pretty obvious at this point. The authorities pressed forward and investigators made this breakthrough. The brother tried to convince everyone he was innocent. It came down to the brother. Basically, this guy that came forward and confessed, he was originally hired to be on the train and to administer the poison.
Right.
He backed out at the last minute, maybe, guilty conscience. And then the brother stepped in and said, I'll do it for a cut of the insurance money.
Is that why they were getting Vietnamese women? Because it's easier to bring in a foreigner?
I don't know. Maybe that was the plan. Like he's just remarrying every couple of years and doing this same insurance job. So the brother was never on the train that derailed. He bought a ticket for it, but he never actually got on the train. What they discovered was he had parked his car near these like mangrove trees where the derailment occurred. Soon as the train derailed, he sprinted out from the trees. Some eyewitnesses saw him and thought he was coming to help, but really he was coming to poison her. For some reason, I think the biggest problem with their initial plan, because they wanted to poison her at the scene, the car that she was in didn't even derail. So what they did was while everyone's like in the chaos of this crash, he meets his brother with the wife and they'd given her some sedative or something. They both pick her up and carry her to one of the derailed carriages. And so all these eyewitnesses are like, yeah, we saw these two guys carrying this woman to one of
towards one of the derailed carriages.
We couldn't figure out what they were doing.
Wow.
Another young girl said, oh yeah, I saw his car parked over there and I saw him running like before the train even crashed. So ultimately he got done and, happy ending to the story. He got thrown in prison and there's a couple of pics of him there.
Was there any history with his wives?
No, I think he was just using his brother's wives, but he's still in prison to this day. It's funny because
so he should be.
There's a bit of a following for these guys where there's some people believe that they were set up and that.
Yeah, but I'm sorry. Once people see you carrying the body, and your previous wife died of a snake bite.
Yeah. I don't know if you've got that all that data, how you can come to the conclusion. So, yeah, a couple of great stories from. What's his name again? Moondog151. He's a great poster. I'll link to his user profile, Moondog151, in the show notes, mysteriousuniverse.org. Again, he mostly posts true crime.
Sure.
But it's pretty good stuff, like pretty interesting stories. There's a lot of stories of one of the other ones I was going to mention, but I won't talk about the full case. But it reminded me of Missing 411. It was, again, in Taiwan. It was a woman with her young daughter. And she got on this elevator in some office building that had a few apartments and she was never seen again. She got on the lift and she was never seen again. There was footage of her getting on the lift, but there was no footage of her getting out. So the footage of the camera on the hallway, it's like no one ever got off that lift. It's like she vanished in the lift. But what was strange about it is next to the lift or inside the lift, both of their shoes were removed. Their clothes were taken off and folded and placed on top of the shoes and they vanished.
Did they climb out? Did they go into the shaft?
Well, there's this famous story or famous case from the country where they found a woman – stuffed into an air vent. Like she'd crawled into an air vent and died, or she got murdered somehow. I can't remember, but it was like she was in this really bizarre position.
That's not like the Eliza Lamb case, is it?
I think it might be.
Where she was found in the water tank.
Yeah, they mentioned the Eliza Lamb case.
Yeah, but she, if you recall, if you see the elevator footage, it's like she's fleeing some invisible assailant.
Yeah, they mentioned that. And so they had the police had that in mind. And so they checked everything in the building, like checked the water tank, checked the pipes, checked the vents. They came back and did it two or three times. But no one ever complained of a smell. There was no trace of them. No one ever complained about the water. No one saw them leave. No one's seen them since. They've just vanished off the face of the earth after they entered this lift. It's really bizarre.
This sounds like the Johatsu thing, though, like in Japan where people want to disappear.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and they do. They go to these extreme lengths. In fact, there was a television show that was based around this of a woman fleeing her abusive husband. I think it's called Light of My Lion or something, or Ryan, which is Japanese for lion. But basically, like, she sets up this scene of this woman who she disappears. She and her kid disappears. Mm. And the way that they disappear is that their shoes are left on a bridge over a gully where there's this flowing water. And it's like, she clearly jumped. If you haven't seen it, go watch it because I won't tell you what happens. But yeah, like it comes across. They've clearly jumped.
Fun stuff. That's a wrap for this show. What a banger. Another banger.
Never go back to that library ever again. Okay. Even if there's literally banging going on here from renovations.
Just... What if I want to go there and harass some young underage girls? That seems to be the place to go, according to the reviews.
Probably not a good idea either. You know, I would stand against
that. Don't clip that.
Look, I let a few, I let a few things slide, but I'm sorry. Like, you know, our values differ on that one.
But the Google reviews say that's where you need to go to do that. That's the place.
Are you serious?
Yeah, if you want to get meth or if you want to harass women, the Maroochydore Library, apparently, allegedly.
I just figured it was any public library in Australia, to be honest, but okay. Well.
According to the Google reviews. Mm. That's a wrap for this show. Thank you so much for listening and watching. If you want to get access to all the good stuff coming up, remind us what is in store for our Plus members.
The Metalloids. We're going to be following the strange saga of the wave, or indeed the flap, of humanoids that crossed the US in 1973 from an entirely new perspective. You know, it's not just the Pennsylvania stuff we reported in the past. It was compiled by David Webb. And we're looking at some of the strange similarities in these reports of craft, entities, weird electricity-stealing creatures, all that kind of stuff coming up the Plus extension.
Are they robots?
Yeah, there's some robotic beings.
Like, why didn't you just call them robots? Why are they metalloids?
They're not all robots. They're not all robots, so that's why.
Some of them are sentient metalloids.
Yeah, look, I'll explain the Plus.
Mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Sign up today, help support your favorite show. You get access to the big extensions we do every single Friday. And of course, an exclusive season running every Tuesday for our Plus members. And again, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Welcome back to your Plus extension. Great to have you with us.